premiers. We've got something on HistoryNet, so I won't dwell into that, but there's a lot of turning points. We've had about 38, which is about one fewer than governors and governors general. They vary in capability and in length of tenure. Interestingly, the first New Zealand-born prime minister wasn't until 1925, so in that sense, they weren't representative of the average New Zealander for quite some time. And as you can see, a number of them have never been elected to anything, because with the old upper house, the Legislative Council, you could be appointed by the government. You never had to stand for office, whereas nowadays you can't be Prime Minister without first being an MP. So there's quite a big difference there. What can we say about premiers? I showed you all those beards right at the beginning. You look at the lists of who was premier, and it's this and that and that. Very often, quite short terms for their ministries. You don't have to memorise them and their dates, unlike Americans who can rattle off every president and his dates. But the important thing to understand is that there was a lot more stability than those changes of ministry suggest, because a lot of these guys stayed in the ministries, regardless of whoever was at the top as the figurehead. So there was a lot of stability. You know, people like Julius Vogel were there for about 15 years, regardless of whether he was premier or Waterhouse was premier or someone else. In the days before political parties like National and Labour, a lot of it was grouped around regional issues, quite parochial. Auckland and Otago might gang up against Wellington and Canterbury, or vice versa, and around personalities. And Vogel, I'll come to later, was one of those big polarising and attracting personalities. The first challenge that they faced as a group was getting control of native affairs, as it was called, and then internal defence. So that happened in the 1860s. So that made us really fully self-governing. It was about a decade and a bit after 1856. And then the second challenge was eliminating provincial governments, because under the 1852 Constitution, we had six, and they later fractured into up to 10 provincial governments. And if you were living in Dunedin in the wealthy 1870s, when Dunedin was the biggest city in the country and Otago was the most prosperous, you took more attention of what was happening in the provincial government in Dunedin than you did in Wellington. And the same with Christchurch in the 1860s versus Parliament as it then was in Auckland. So there was quite a debate, and you know, Fox, one of the early premiers, wanted most of the power or more of the power to be with the provincial governments. Stafford, his main opponent, wanted it the other way around. So there was quite a debate over this. People were either provincialists or they were centralists. It wasn't automatically assumed that we would be a single state like we are today. There was the possibility that we could have gone very much the way of Australia and Canada with quite powerful provinces. So that debate was fought, and a lot of historians argue it was around common sense and railway lines. Once you got steamships and railway lines linking provinces, suddenly you start to see the things that hold the country together a bit better. The other thing to say about responsible government is it's an incredibly new idea. You know, we don't think twice about the fact that we make our own laws and the New Zealand Prime Minister can, with Cabinet, decide what's going to happen on this and he'll represent us here and there. But in most empires, whether you're talking about Spanish or the Russian or the British, that had never been the case. 1776 in the USA. Up until then, it had royal governors. They had gatherings and under various names and assemblies, but they were very much like Auckland in 1853. They were advisory. And in a sense, who would have thought in the 1840s, for example, that Wellington would make its own decisions on things? Because after all, it was the British Empire, which was all over the globe. So it was quite a radical idea. It came out of some disturbances in Canada. At that stage, there were two big provinces in Canada. There had been riots, and they sent out some people from Britain to investigate the causes and see what the solution might be. And the result was with Lord Durham, produced a report that had an incredibly long title, which is always known to historians as simply the Durham Report. And the gist of this was that if you gave Britons living overseas, and we, after all, were British citizens until after the Second World War, if you gave them all the rights and freedoms and privileges that they could enjoy back home in Stratford-on-Avon or Blyth or wherever, they would remain as loyal as British citizens in Britain. In other words, trust, give them full freedom, and they'll be held together by common loyalties and united around the symbol of the monarch. Now, it was quite radical, but it worked. Within about 20 years, most of the settler colonies in North America and Australasia had their own self-government, their own parliaments, and were able to pass laws for their own governance. Now, there were limitations in this. Britain still set all the international policy. So a colonial premier didn't have a foreign policy role. There were no embassies here to go around and have quiet chats and cocktails in. No defence policy, no trade policy, because the Royal Navy protected the empire and Britain set the external trade policy. Interestingly, they could be Catholic. Weld, who was one of our early premiers, was Catholic. That was unthinkable. I mean, even today, Tony Blair had to leave the British Prime Ministership to convert to Catholicism. New Zealand's Anglican Church is not an established church, unlike the UK. Until the 1890s and the arrival of the Liberals, the Premier didn't have to worry about being a party political leader. You know, you don't have the hassles that running a party and going to conferences and disciplining MPs brought. The absence of that, though, meant that you were terribly vulnerable to a vote of no confidence on the floor of the House of Representatives. So you end up with a lot of the Victorian ministries crashing because they lose confidence while Parliament is sitting. So that's quite a different spin. Now, after the Liberals and then the Reform Party come along, only once does a New Zealand Prime Minister lose the job because of a vote in the House, and that's in 1912 at the very dying end of the Liberal Party. So a modern Prime Minister, if he or she has the numbers and a good election result, doesn't have to worry about being ambushed by the opposition. You might have to worry about your deputy, but you don't have to worry about the opposition for 3 years. And I'll just whiz through. We're almost at the end. Some people, I think, are interesting. Henry Sewell, he was there for a fortnight, our first self-governing premier. Now, it's easy to laugh at that. But, you know, the really important thing was we embraced responsible government so early. He became elected premier, and then when he lost the vote in the House of Representatives, he resigned, and the ministry changed. There were no revolutions, there were no military coups or anything like that. So whatever the occasional bump in New Zealand political history, it's been a remarkably smooth adventure in democracy, so to speak, and there are still nations on earth that can't make that sort of peaceful transition. Another of these early beards, Edward Stafford, premier three times. He was in many ways a rather dull person, but he was a safe pair of hands, and he put in some really lengthy terms by the standards of the day. He was the one who saw the need for a strong government at the centre, and he was a real positive person. His opponent all the way through was a chap called Fox, who lived up to his surname, and it was an ideas man, erratic, all over the place, strong provincialist, but not a great nation builder. Politics sometimes throw up great ideas, people. I guess Roger Douglas would be the last and most recent one in New Zealand history. This was the great thinker of the day. He was premier, but he was more often influential because he controlled the finance and development and railway portfolios. And that's just another reminder that if you're going through lists of prime ministers and premiers, often the people who are just as influential don't appear at the top of the table. Cabinet ministers can be incredibly powerful figures. I think that Roger Douglas, historically, is more significant than David Lange. Ruth Richardson, arguably more than Jim Bolger. And it was the same in these colonial periods as well. Often a cabinet minister can be very important. And the last slide is, can't get away from this guy, Richard Seddon. When we were doing the exhibition, I'd sometimes ask people, be a bit nasty, stand by the door, wait for the public to come in and say, oh, who's your favourite Prime Minister, or who do you remember as a Prime Minister? And if they're old enough, over 40, they remember Muldoon, who was always that B Muldoon, or good old Piggy, depending on their politics. They'll probably remember Savage, and then they'll remember him. And it's, I think, no coincidence that his statue stands in front of Parliament like this, hectoring the people. He was a very impressive character. He was in some ways one of our most inspirational prime ministers, not so much for deep thinking, but just for sheer energy. His downfall was like a number of prime ministers. He was meddlesome and wanted to do everything himself. So he did a great deal of long-term damage to the Liberal Party by micromanaging his cabinet. But there's certainly no mistaking the fact that he was a great actor. And I remember coming across a note of his that he sent to someone that he was going to go out and he was going to play the audience like a piano. And then he said at the end of it, I really sometimes have to worry about pretending to be dumber than I am. And that's another long tradition in New Zealand politics, being the ordinary man, as they used to say. Keith Holyoake was the last one who, he and Norm Kirk in the 1960s and 70s used to have debates in Parliament about who'd had the least education.